Welcome to Act and Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. I'm your host, Eric Cohn. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to ask that if you're listening to us on our website, that you navigate right now to the show notes for this episode, because that's where you'll find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else where you listen to fine podcasts. And if you like this program, please leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts so as to help more people find our show. This week, I'm joined by Dylan Pauman, executive editor of the Journal of Markets and Morality and a research fellow here at Acton, and Dan Huger, Acton's librarian and a research associate. And this week, we're joined by a special guest, Karen Swallow Pryor. Karen is the author of The Evangelical Imagination, How Stories, Images, and Metaphors Created a Culture in Crisis, and On Reading Well, Finding the Good Life Through Great Books, among other titles. Her writing has appeared at Christianity Today, The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, First Things, and various other places. In addition, Dr. Pryor is a columnist for Religion News Service, a contributing editor for Comment, a founding member of the Pelican Project, and a senior fellow at the Trinity Forum. She's also the author of the essay, Who Will Comfort Me? The Total Care of Cecily Saunders, which appears in the spring 2024 issue of our magazine, Religion and Liberty. Religion and Liberty is available at select Barnes & Noble and Books A Million stores across the country, but you can save yourself the time and trouble by subscribing to get our beautiful magazine in your mailbox 4 times per year for only $29.99. We'll include a link in the show notes where you can subscribe, along with a link to Karen's essay that we'll be discussing today. This week, we'll be discussing where free markets and free enterprise fit in the modern conservative movement, and how college administrations should be responding to campus encampments and protests. But first, I want to go to Karen's essay, again entitled, Who Will Comfort Me? The Total Care of Cecily Saunders. Karen, why don't you start by telling us what your essay is about?
That's a great question. I had not known about Cecily Saunders until I was asked to research for this story and write it. It fits into my larger interest because I am very pro-life from womb to tomb. And obviously, euthanasia is a very pressing issue right now. And hospice is in many ways sort of the opposite of euthanasia. So these are issues that matter to me. But I actually did not know about this woman, this amazing woman who is considered the founder of the modern hospice movement. Dame Cecily Saunders, was a British subject. And her life is just one in which she lived the kinds of values that she promoted. She died just in 2005, which was interesting for me because most of the people that I write about have been dead for a long time. And so to be able to listen to interviews with her and read recent biographers and hear testimonies of people who knew her and worked with her was just even more inspiring than her life itself. And she has left quite a legacy.
Bring us up to speed then on the development of where did this vision of hospice care come from and how did it become, something I think we're all familiar with these days?
Right. So Saunders came of age and went to school at Oxford right around the years of World War II. So that's sort of the context. As World War II, she wanted to leave school and do something more practical, which in her case ended up being nursing, which was, interestingly enough, a kind of rebellious move by her because her wealthy parents had more in mind for her than to become, a common laborer like a nurse. In the context of the war, she wanted to do something practical. She wanted to help. And it was also in those years when euthanasia began being discussed in the context of sort of modern civilization as a solution to modern problems. I mean, obviously, euthanasia has been around since and assisted suicide, and various terms are used to describe that, but they've been around since ancient times. But it was during the years around World War II that this began to be discussed as a civil and solution to social problems. And so Saunders just in the midst of this, had a relationship with a patient who was dying of cancer, and their conversation led her to understand that physical suffering is not the only or even the worst kind of suffering that those who are dying are undergoing, that they need total care for total pain. And so she wanted to find a way to comfort people who are dying. And of course, in the context of modern medicine, everything and modern everything is about progress and solutions. And so the idea of not being able to cure someone would be considered a failure. And nobody really wanted to put their time, money, interest, and resources into that, except for Saunders. She pioneered research into aid to the dying and saw dying well as not a failure, but a success.
One of the fascinating pieces of little nuggets in this wonderful essay that I really loved is when she was at Oxford, she was in a PPE program before abandoning this. And one of abandoning that to do her very valuable hospice work, and one of her professors, I think, if I remember rightly, said that, you know, basically, you know, there's a scarce number of people in the world that have your sorts of talent, and any old person can be a nurse.
Yes.
And I thought that was very, very striking in light of the sort of pioneering work she did. She did utilize all of her talents of care. She went back to school to become a medical doctor when that became essential to the mission. What do you think in terms of, you know, there's a story here about euthanasia, but there's also a story here about vocation and what service to others looks like in the world. Could you tease that out a little bit for our listeners?
Yes, I love that angle of the story. There's so much rich convergence here of many things going on in society at that time and then also at our time. And so, again, we look at this person who was a woman, a female, that's really important to understand, and who, as I said before, was actually sort of rebelling against her parents and against her, at least one professor, one dean at her school, by moving into a traditionally female occupation. Which is what she wanted to do. And not only a traditionally female occupation, but also one that, as we've said, was considered one that any old person could do. And yet she did end up becoming a physician. So clearly, in order to fulfill the mission that she had from the beginning, and so she did drop out of school to become a nurse. And then because of the physical labor involved in being a nurse, and this is another interesting part of her story, but also I think a crucial part of how we understand calling and vocation, she was a tall woman. Her body was tall and kind of awkward. And so that actually brought to her more physical pain. She had back problems her whole life. And so being a nurse actually ended up having being ruled out because of the pain it caused her back. She just physically couldn't do it and went back to school to become a social worker. And in the process of doing that work, was advised by a physician, look, if you want to do this work, you've got to become a doctor because it's the doctors who are making these decisions. So all of these things, it took a long time, but all of these things, her personality, her little bit of a rebellious spirit, not necessarily doing what everyone wanted her to do, her physical body, the times, all of these things funnel together to help her find and fulfill her calling, which was to be a medical doctor in a time and a place and with a personality and a set of experiences that could challenge the status quo, which is essentially, you know, dying people aren't worth our time and interest. And she said, yes, they are.
So it is Holy Week in the Orthodox Church this week. I happen to be Greek Orthodox. So I was reading your essay last night, and I had just come from church, and I couldn't help but think about everything this week means. And I thought in particular of Psalm 22, at least in most English Bibles, 21 and some others, that Christ quotes from the cross. It begins with, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then there's this long description of how, you know, the writer is persecuted and afflicted and people are jeering and mocking and all of these things. And then it has this turn right in the middle that says, but the Lord has answered me. And it starts talking about the promise of what's going to come despite all of his suffering. And at one point it says, all those who go down to the dust shall bow before him, even he who cannot keep himself alive. And it, you know, you mentioned the faith background in your essay of hospice in the ancient world being a place for pilgrims on the way to the Holy Land or back who couldn't make it all the way, as would happen. There'd be disease, there'd be, you know, all sorts of reasons why everything was dangerous in the ancient world. Charlemagne, for example, opened, a hostel, which I'm sure probably included hospice in Jerusalem. And I just, I can't separate this from, although I do think there's a natural law argument to be made for hospice, but the idea that even a suffering life is valuable because life is valuable, that, you know, every breath shall praise the Lord, as Psalm 150 says, even he who cannot keep himself alive. I wonder if you could talk more about that background of faith in general for hospice, for Saunders in particular, and also for you as an author, and, you know, what you've taken away. Because I know writing an essay like this, it's, you know, you can sit down and read it in maybe 10 minutes, but it takes hours and hours and hours to write something like this. Sometimes, you know, just pages and pages of notes and so much more time, than what gets delivered to the reader. So, you know, what especially spoke to you and to your faith? And, you know, maybe even if there's anything that unfortunately ended up on the cutting room floor, just to get down to that word count, that could further, you know, enlighten us in that regard.
Yeah, no, this really is, I think, an important part of the discussion, because as you said, there is a natural law argument to be made for the preservation of all human life. And yet, even entering into my research on this woman whom, as I said before, I didn't know anything about, I was not surprised to find that there was a faith element, because even if there's a natural law argument to be made, usually there's something else behind the passion and persistence and courage that it takes to stand athwart and say stop to society, as Saunders did in her gentle, loving, and courageous way in advocating for total life care at end of life. And so, her background is so interesting because she grew up in a non-religious background. As I said, her parents were, you know, up and coming, well-to-do people who had dreams for their daughter to be, you know, a new woman in this age of rising women's rights and freedom and liberation. And so Saunders had no religious background, and didn't really, wasn't looking for one until she fell in during college with a group of evangelical students, and spent time with them and ended up having a conversion experience and attending John Stott's church, the Anglican church in London, and became an evangelical. And yet from the beginning, she had a very ecumenical spirit. That first person I mentioned that she met who was dying and who gave her this vision for pursuing what would become the modern hospice movement was a Jewish man. He was from Poland, from an encampment, and was dying of cancer. And he wanted comfort from her. And when in his last days, when she was trying to comfort him, she turned to his religion, to the Old Testament, which of course is part of the Christian faith, but she didn't try to proselytize him or convert him. And so that kind of attitude marked her approach, and still today is part of the hospice movement, that whatever the person's religious beliefs are or aren't, we provide comfort to them on those terms. So that was an interesting part of her story. And one that, you know, because I am an evangelical, but I also am one who has always lived and existed or mostly in diverse areas where there are people of different beliefs or no beliefs. And it's important to me to be able to move easily among such people and to be a witness with my life and not necessarily try to convert them through proselytizing. So I found an example in Saunders who maintained integrity and consistency with her faith, and by being like Christ was able to serve water and just give shelter and to give clothing to those in need. And now she allows so many others to do that in hospice.
Karen, talk to me about what is going on and what has been going on in the last few years in Canada. This is where you end up at the end of your essay, talking about the MAID program in Canada. Describe that program a bit. Describe, you know, the culture that exists around that, where it intersects with Cecily Saunders and the rest of your essay, and what we should understand about Canada's program as perhaps a harbinger of things to come in the future in other places as well. I know you mentioned that it was kind of formed by, you know, World War II, and certainly one can go back to Nazi Germany, and you know, a lot of attention, of course, is given to what happened to Jews in the Holocaust because they were Jews. But the view of the value of human life, the belief in eugenics, was such that, you know, people at an older age with what were deemed to be low quality of life were considered easily expendable, if not the kind of people who leached off of the public good. So unpack that if you can for us.
Yeah, and of course, this program in Canada is the one that has been getting a lot of the headlines lately as we discuss these issues. And what made Saunders' story, I think, so crucial for our time right now. So the MAID program, the acronym is MAID, and it stands for Medical Aid or Assistance in Dying. And part of my research actually was delving into all of the different terms that are used, because there are different terms, and also the terms change over time, especially, you know, with the progression being sort of becoming more and more euphemistic and more sort of covering what's happening. So MAID in Canada has two different approaches. One is basically what would traditionally be called euthanasia, and then the other is physician-assisted suicide. And so one is self-administered, and then the other would be helped, receiving help with a physician, but it's still ending one's life intentionally and with the support of the medical system. And so sort of in broad sweeps, what's been happening in Canada with this, since it was implemented, I think the first year was 2015, is that the conditions under which one might qualify for medically assisted death are becoming broader and broader. And so at the time I was writing this, there was about to be another broadening of the law that I think has been suspended for now, that would allow just, you know, teenagers who are depressed to qualify for medically assisted death. That's on hold for now with the last that I read. But even apart from that, there have been high profile cases of people who are not suffering terminal diseases, but who are suffering from anxiety or depression. One that I profiled was a man who suffered chronic pain, but whose greatest source of grief was that he, because of his chronic pain, he was going to lose his housing. He couldn't afford to pay his housing bill. And so he saw no future, and he planned to have his death. But when his story was made public, people stepped in and raised so much money to help him, that he solved that problem, which really was the greatest weight that he carried. And so, again, not every single problem is solved by money, but he even testified that it wasn't just the money; it was the support, the emotional support, the love, the care, And that is what is missing most for people who choose to die. It's not just the physical suffering, because there is medicine available that can alleviate the physical suffering at the end of death. It's really everything else that's so easy to give up on, whether as a giver or a receiver, when this other solution is so easily available.
So one of the things, when you talk about that care, that community of care that came and supported this man and made him feel that life is worth living, that transformed his life and his experience. But, you know, in all my experience with hospice nurses throughout my life, and I've known several, I used to work in a funeral home, and they are always some of the kindest, gentlest mm-hmm. people I've ever met. And I think when you deal compassionately with the sick and dying, that also transforms you in the process mm-hmm. of doing that. The first penance I ever received was to pray for the sick and dying. And that's something that I've always thought about a lot. And I think that that has a transforming nature to it. Could you maybe talk a little bit either about your essay's subject and how that sort of care transformed her, or how you've maybe seen in your research this care transform not only the folks that receive it, but the folks that give it?
I love that question. And I want to be completely candid and humble and transparent in saying that I am the last person on earth who would choose to be a nurse or be involved in giving care for people. That is just something that, like most of us, I think I would rather avoid and want to stay far away from. This is God's work through the hands and feet of people who are called to do this. And yet we all will be called at some point in our lives, as our own loved ones grow up and age and get sick and ill and die. It happens to all of us. We're all called to be part of this chapter of life, not eventually our own, of course, but of those around us. And for Saunders, again, she just encountered this early in life through her work and her calling to be a nurse. But she also, I mean, she chose to immerse herself. Even as a nurse, she could have chosen any particular area, but this is the area that she was drawn to. So again, going back to an earlier part of the conversation, I think it truly was a calling. And, you know, I'll just, I guess this will count as part of my research. In my book, which you mentioned before, on Reading Well, I have a chapter on kindness and a chapter on love. And in both of those chapters, I study virtues, the lens of literature. And in both of those chapters, I choose works of literature centered on the dying. In the first case, the death of Ivan Ilyich, who was dying. And in the chapter on love, a short story by George Saunders called The 10th of December, about a man who is dying and sets out to end his life. And in both of those stories, because again, literature is my thing. So that's the kind of research I love to do, is to read literature. And so in both of those stories, the freedom and the transformation and the redemption that the dying characters receive is through either receiving or giving care to others, even in their deaths. And they are just such powerful stories. And in particular, I love George Saunders' story, 10th of December, because the protagonist in the story, who's dying himself and who has watched his stepfather die years before and wanted to avoid bringing that kind of pain and suffering into his family's life, the whole point of the story, spoiler alert, is that he realizes that his wife wants to care for him and love him, even in the worst physical parts of his death and decaying, and that to allow her to do that is a gift, and it's not his gift to take from her, to allow her to care for him through the end. And that is the gift that we can all give our loved ones, is to allow them to love us and care for us until the end. And, you know, I say that it hit my life personally because my own father-in-law took his own life years ago because he did not want to his family to have to take care of him. But that was a gift that he took because they wanted to do that for him, and they weren't allowed to. And so, you know, so it's easy to understand why people think that way. But in real life experiences and in literature and in the research and in Saunders' extensive work, we must come to understand that caring for one another isn't a distraction from life. It's what life is all about.
That's a good tee up for what I wanted to ask about. So one of the other things I thought about reading your essay was COVID and how difficult it was that so many people, because of all the restrictions, had to die alone. And it wasn't just difficult for them, but for all the people who loved them. There's a economist, she's a health economist named Sarah Hammersma, and I've seen her speak twice now. She spoke at the recent Kuiper conference here in town that we co-sponsored, and she's very pro-life and does a lot of work in, you know, prenatal, postnatal scholarship, economics, and she talks about the weird disconnect between panels at conferences. Well, she'll go and researchers will be talking about, you know, how, you know, the mother who's pregnant and, you know, how healthy the baby is, how different things she does will affect postnatal outcomes. And there's just this general agreement that everybody wants mother and baby to do well. And then she'll go to another panel and it'll be about abortion. And she says the first time she went to one of these, she expected them to use like a euphemism, because you mentioned this, how the terminology keeps changing around medical assistance in dying now instead of euthanasia or whatever. And there's a similar sort of thing. And what she was surprised to see, she thought they'd say something like, you know, the fetus or whatever, you know, use that kind of term. And she said, instead, they don't mention the baby at all. It's just a complete dehumanization. The baby isn't there to them, to these researchers. It's, you know, not even considered. And I feel that a lot with, you know, this you know, assisted suicide, medical euthanasia, as you mentioned, the terms, you do actually do a good job defining them in your essay, but I'm using them a little more loosely. But it forgets about everyone else. And there's no person who's just a person. Everyone is a son or a daughter of someone. A lot of people are a brother, a sister, and even a father or mother of other people as well. People are friends. C.S. Lewis in The Four Loves talks about one of the things about friendship is that you give some of yourself and your identity to someone else. So it's not just that, you know, Dan and I are friends, but there's part of me that you can only see when Dan and I are together. And when you lose that friend, you've actually lost this part of yourself. And there's just something about the anthropology of this policy. Even to be fair, I'm sure there are some very well-intended people, of course, who they don't want people to suffer. And they just think, you know, here we are in the modern world, and yet we still have people suffering before they die. We should do something about that. But I think that's completely backwards, and that they're just missing this whole reality of the human person and the worth of life. So I'm curious, and I would love to hear more about that as well, because I have experienced hospice in terms of a friend of mine, old friend from really high school is when I met him, but he passed away last July, so very young, early 40s. But I remember being at his home and being there when he came and the hospice came, and how they were so able to comfort his family. It wasn't just about making him comfortable as he died, but helping everyone else there all the people who were grieving and suffering. Sure, they weren't dying tomorrow, right? We're all dying anyway. But they were suffering and they needed care. And here you had these amazing, kind people, as Dan mentioned, who were there for them in the midst of that. And so I'm curious if that side of it is also traceable to Saunders, that care not just for the person in isolation, but for the whole community of people in that suffer when one person dies.
Yeah, that is actually part of Saunders' legacy, because the hospital that she built after going through all this schooling and doing all this research and again becoming poised to really fulfill this calling, she built a hospital from the ground up to provide end-of-life care, which again was not, this was already going on. I mean, Saunders didn't do this in a vacuum, but what she did that was so different was to devote resources for research and training to hospice, which wasn't really being done. And also when building the hospital, she built it as a place of hospitality, not only for those who were dying, but for the family members who would be coming to be with their loved ones at the end. And so this is carried through it. As most of us probably have had some experience with hospice in the lives of those that we know and love, and of course it's expanded. Now we understand that it's not just in a place like a hospital, but hospice is now hospice care can be given anywhere, whether it's in the hospital or in a nursing home or in someone's home, which is very common today. And so yes, this part, I think it all goes back. I mean, so many of these, this bigger question is so theological and ontological. And it has to do with the meaning of suffering. The answer to that question begins with what it means to be a human being. Because we do, as responsible stewards of God's creation, put animals out of their misery if it comes to that. We kill animals for food and so forth, but we treat human beings, or have traditionally treated human beings, differently because there is something ontologically different about human beings. If we're Christians, we know it is that we are made in the image of God, and being made in the image of God and looking to Christ as our example, as you mentioned earlier, in looking at Holy Week, Christ's suffering is the emblematic picture of suffering. It was not meaningless at all. It wasn't just suffering the way that an animal suffers, and human suffering is the same. And we just, in the late modern age, even as Christians, I think we don't think, especially Protestant evangelicals like myself, we don't think enough about suffering and the meaning of suffering, not only for ourselves, but for those around us. And so if it's something, that we do together as loved ones, as families, in those moments, I think we can begin to think about the meaning of suffering. But it's something, again, like all physical decay and pain, we'd rather avoid, and we like to think that we can, because modern medicine and technology gives us that illusion.
The essay is Who Will Comfort Me? The Total Care of Cicely Saunders, that appears in the spring 2024 issue of our magazine, Religion and Liberty. We will put a link to that essay in the show notes. The author is Karen Swallow Pryor. Karen, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
So last week at National Review, Eric Erickson, the talk radio host and founder of the website Red State. I remember around that time, a friend of mine once asked me if I was going to capitalize on Eric Erickson's kind of burgeoning popularity and political celebrity by changing my name to Eric Ericone. I opted not to go that route, but I always think about that every time I hear Eric's name. He wrote this piece entitled, "The Conservative Movement is Defending Free Markets from Both Sides." And makes the case that limited government and free markets are under threat from the left and the right, and there are what he considers to be principled conservative organizations pushing back on that. He covers some of the work of Americans for Prosperity, of the Club for Growth, Mike Pence's newly launched American Solutions Project, organizations like the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, FreeOp, as well as National Taxpayers Union, Taxpayers Protection Alliance, Stand Together. There's a lot of people, of course, working out there in furtherance of the idea of the importance of free enterprise and free markets. What I found interesting and instructive was one of the responses to Eric's piece, which comes from Wesley Coopersmith, who is the chief of staff to Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation. And because this was just a relatively short tweet thread, I'm going to give you exactly what Coopersmith said. This piece sadly defines the problem with establishment conservatism. Free markets and limited government are not ends in themselves, but rather means to an end. That is, a justly ordered society full of human flourishing. The conservative movement must stop defending free markets, parenthetical, though it is a good, and start defending the American family for which the free market was created to serve. Likewise, limited government is not an end unto itself, but rather a means to an end that is self-governance. This disconnect, by the way, is why Donald Trump captured the conservative movement starting in 2016. He doesn't defend vague principles of conservatism, but rather the people and institutions those principles are designed to serve. The so-called three-legged stool coalition made sense for its time, but a new coalition is needed today for today's challenges. I believe this new coalition should center around the traditional family, self-governance, and national sovereignty. A new coalition does not mean we are abandoning conservatism, but rather fighting to preserve it. I do think this highlights one of the tensions that exists now. One can point to advocates, organizations who believe that the state and politics have a bigger role in directing the economy than perhaps conservative philosophy, ideology held before, really the last 10 years or so. I'll throw this question out there. Feel free to, of course, jump on any of this, Eric's original argument, Wesley Coopersmith's response. But how should we understand the role of free enterprise, free markets within a greater philosophy, ideology, movement? Take it from any direction you want.
So I found this exchange to be a bit bizarre in that I first actually saw the tweets and then I read the article. And if you only read the tweets, you would get this impression that Erickson is some sort of, although I'm yet to meet one, an actual
market fundamentalist.
Yes, a free market fundamentalist or something like that, who only cares about the market and economics and, you know, GDP growth or something like that. When you actually read his article, he explicitly says free markets are good because they are good for families. Like, it's in there. And that's like the point that apparently Coopersmith seems to think, you know, well, basically either Coopersmith is illiterate or cynical. I mean, that's the only conclusion I can come to. Because either he read that and did not understand what it meant, or he didn't care to read it, or, you know, didn't care about representing it, you know, fairly. But that said, I think they're both a little cynical. I mean, Erickson, throughout his essay, is just promoting all of these different conservative organizations, many of which he is involved with at various points. And it felt a little like an advertisement, in which one of them was conspicuously missing, that being the Heritage Foundation, right? And then, I mean, the other cynical thing is, how is someone at Heritage saying, look, this is what established conservatism is? I thought Heritage was establishment conservatism. I think it's far more accurate to say that whatever Heritage is saying right now is representative of the establishment. So there's this really disingenuous, we're the outsiders sort of thing when you work at the largest conservative think tank by far in the country and most influential by far. So I think there's just a lot of bad actors here. Now, as for the question itself, I mean, this is a point that we've been making here at the Acton Institute for 30 years, more than that now, 34 years, that it's not, you know, economics is not an end in itself. But if you look at the data, which data does matter, just because someone talks about a number doesn't mean they don't care about people. The point is they care about lots of people. That's what the numbers represent. It goes hand in hand with flourishing families, right? The better the economy, the more opportunities are there, and the fewer barriers to market entry, which is what a free market is, the more opportunities families have to flourish. Getting an income is not just about dollars, as anyone who has a family to support knows. You don't go to work because you're greedy, for the most part. You go because you got bills to pay. Why do you have bills to pay? Because you got kids, you got a wife, you got, you know, whatever. Like, this is how the real world works, and it's silly for people to posture as if that's not the case. Really, what's been going on, I'd say since 2016 or so, is a lot of, just bad actors trying to paint their opposition, who support free markets, as opposed to, you know, them being the industrial policy experts that will somehow magically wave a wand and the government will make the economy better. They paint the opponents as these uncaring people, as people who don't really care about, you know, hardworking American families and all of that. That is just not fair or true at all. Yeah, I think free markets matter for families. I think it's great to point out the connection between those two, but it's not as if we didn't know. It's that other people came along wanting to ride the coattails of someone who currently is on trial for paying off a porn star with whom he had an affair, as if he is the defender of traditional American family values. I want to ride his coattails. And he spoke to that average American. This is all nonsense, and that's exactly how we should treat it. I don't think this kind of position deserves anyone's time anymore. It's tired at this point. It's been 8 years. The man lost rightly in 2020, and he's, you know, whether he wins or lose, he does not deserve to win, nor has he ever. And I think it's right to say that. And right to take a stand. I'm not, by the way, endorsing any particular candidate. I don't happen to like basically any of them right now, in case anyone wonders. This is not a political statement. This is about principle. Last I knew, which unfortunately was about 8 years ago, conservatives were supposed to be the ones that cared about character and principle. And I would love for them to get back to that.
The problem that I have with this whole thing is similar to the problem that I had about 8 years ago when we had this kind of sudden onset need to discuss the idea of nationalism, which is my problem is not the text. My problem is the context. And the reason that we were discussing nationalism was because Donald Trump had glommed on to this phrase that he poorly understood because he thought it sounded good. And there are a whole lot of implications, not just to nationalism as a term, but also to things like America First. And there's a whole history there that you know, in a way, I forgive Donald Trump to a certain extent because he doesn't know any of this, nor does he wish to know any of this. But it is what I find kind of amazing here is some of the things that, you know, I thought people on the right really well understood, at least in the rhetoric that we're getting particularly. And I think to your point about Eric Erickson's original piece, I think is a completely legitimate criticism of it. In Wesley Cooper Smith's response, it is the phrasing of things like the conservative movement must stop defending free markets, though it is a good, and start defending the American family for which the free market was created to serve. This is going to be, you know, I can make two points here. One, markets have existed as long as human beings have had engaged in any kind of exchange with each other. So this like rhetoric around like the free market being created is problematic to start with. Like, I encourage anyone to go read Deirdre McCloskey's Economic Histories to better understand that, like, these are emergent phenomenons that nobody set out to create. However, the idea, even if you're going to stipulate, you know, as a kind of term of art, saying that the free market was created to serve American families, that's going to be big news to the Dutch, to the Scots. You know, if we want to have this debate about whether it was, you know, the English Enlightenment or the Dutch Enlightenment, where we really had this, you know, McCloskey argues this change in rhetoric and the way that we talk about entrepreneurialism and markets and free exchange between people that creates the explosion, as I remember Deirdre presenting once, like, you know, the hockey stick of human prosperity, where you're just, you're middling along like a dollar a day for all time. And then at some point in the early 1700s, it just starts to explode. Well, why does it do that? McCloskey makes arguments about like the way we talk about these things is important. The rhetoric we use around these things is important. But the idea that it was, again, maybe this is just like lazy tweeting, but, you know, for the start defending the American family for which the free market was created to serve is just a nonsensical phrase. It was not created to serve the American family. It was not created to serve any family in that sense. It was created because there are markets when we exchange with other people. And Dylan's point, of course, is right that there is more to it than that. We talk about that all the time here at the Acton Institute. What are markets for? And it is, again, what bothers me about this isn't the text of what is being said, is the context in which you have seen a move from a belief, and you get this dismissed often as that, like, you just believe in procedural liberalism. Yes, I do happen to think that procedure is good and important. That if you had a go back to trials, there are a lot of people who think that Donald Trump is guilty of the things that he is charged with, but we have a trial for the purpose of establishing whether or not that is true in front of a jury of the person's peers. The process is important, and the process contains a lot of moral content. And to have it so kind of easily dismissed as just being procedural liberalism, as if that's nothing really important, what this speaks to me of is a shift in what people are caring about in some segments of the right, that we are now ends-focused and not means-focused. That we only care about how we get to a certain destination. And, well, you know, if I have to use the blunt power and force of the state in order to achieve the kinds of things that I want, well, then we do that. It is a shift in priorities. It is a shift in philosophy. It is a shift in ideology. And I wish people would at least be honest about that and not say, this is the same old conservatism as before, when to me it is obviously and markedly different.
So there are more sophisticated and less sophisticated versions of arguments. Allow me to give the more sophisticated version of this sort of markets are created. You will find this more sophisticated version in a book called The Great Transformation by Carl Polanyi, who argues that markets are created by states, the enclosure movement in England, all this sorts of this is the sort of argument that it is. And if you want the most sophisticated version of that argument, that's where you go. If you want a very good answer in summary of what modern historiography has done for that argument, there was a piece written, I think, a decade ago by Alex Narasta at the Cato Institute that basically goes through all of the ways that historians have sort of demolished this case that Carl Polanyi made in the succeeding decades. That being said, the American conservative movement is grounded in conserving what? The constitutional order of America and its Republican founding. What is the nature of that order? The nature of that order is one that's constituted to preserve what people at the time called a system of natural liberty. It is no coincidence that the Declaration of Independence and the Wealth of Nations are both published the same year. They arrive out of the same intellectual milieu, some of which is Scottish Enlightenment, some of which is grounded in the Old and New Testaments, some of which is grounded in various sources of Republican understanding of people like Cicero, all of this. All of these people share a conviction that a commercial republic and a commercial society is both necessary, good, and absent tyranny, inevitable. Now, there are famous disagreements among some of the American founders, Jefferson and Hamilton very famously, about the kind of interventions that it's appropriate for states to have in the private lives of citizens and in the economy. All of those positions would be characterized today as free market fundamentalist positions by their opponents. The most expansive arguments that the founders made for an American state are minuscule compared to where we are today. And if the conservative movement is a conservative movement, it has to be grounded in America's liberal and Republican founding. If it's a policy agenda for a certain class of people that exists in America today over and against other groups of people in America today, that may very well be an ideology, but it is not an American conservative ideology. It's something else. Right-wing populism is a thing that exists on its with its own merits and demerits. And I think that's what you're seeing here is you're seeing a transition from a historically grounded American conservatism anchored in the history of the Republic itself versus a sort of right-wing populism electoral strategy.
Because we're running long, I want to move on to our final topic. If you have been following the news, you have probably seen stories of these encampments that are being created at a number of universities, particularly elite universities. Columbia in New York City is, pardon the expression, ground zero for this. You have seen reactions to the attempts to establish these kinds of encampments at different places. Differently, you have the University of Texas in Austin, Texas, where the police disbanded the attempts to establish these, which I found to be further complicated by the comments of Governor Greg Abbott, in which he says that, anti-Semitism essentially has no home here. To me, the problem is not necessarily the views, however repugnant I may find them, that these protesters are expressing. It is problems with the with questions of like, what is the university for, whether it is a good idea to let students start camping on the quad in order to protest, what is the role of protest in one's educational experience, let alone in greater American life. And then you have the example of Ben Sasse, the former senator from Nebraska, who is now president of the University of Florida, who I thought did a very good job of setting out a very clear statement of here's what's allowed. Here's what's not allowed. If you do the things that are not allowed, here's what's going to happen to you. So because we are running short on time, we're going to do this kind of very quickly and go around the horn here. What should university leadership, presidents, administrations at places like Columbia be doing with the problem that they are currently facing of these clearly organized protests in the form of encampments on their campus?
I think, Ben Sasse does have, is setting forth a good model to follow. You say, here's the rules. There's this rule of law, basically. You tell people ahead of time and then you enforce it. I would add, and I'm not saying that they're not doing this at Florida, but I would add, I think one of the fears a lot of these universities have about doing anything is they don't want to be the next Kent State. People still remember that, tragedy back during the Vietnam War. So use nonviolent means. I had a friend who went to Michigan State. Basically, every football game, there's a riot. They win, they're happy, they riot. They lose, they're happy, they're sad, they riot. And I remember him one time saying there was a game. He was not watching the game. He was at Barnes & Noble, and he came out of Barnes & Noble, reading a book, and he looked up, and he looked to the right, and there was a bunch of angry rioters to the right. And then he looked to the left, and there's a bunch of police in riot gear. And right then, they shot tear gas, which landed right in front of him.
Oof.
Which he said he immediately vomited. It was an awful experience.
Yeah.
But you know what? He didn't die, and they dispersed the crowds quite effectively. So if you're wondering what to do, call up Michigan State and say, what do you do every Saturday night in the fall when there's a football game? You can disperse these crowds with non-lethal force. It is absolutely possible, and it can be done. And I would say you do have to take it on a case-by-case basis because otherwise you get people are going to get a whole persecution complex going. They might do that anyway. They're always going to claim, well, they're just shutting us down and they're shills for a colonialist regime and yada, yada, yada. They're going to, you know, that rhetoric's going to happen, but give them as little reason to do it as possible. So I believe it was Colombia. There was an image shared around. There's the organizer who is a genuine anti-Semite, says that Israelis or Zionists don't deserve to live.
Remarkable statement there is the, like, you should be glad I'm not going around murdering Zionists. And it's like, okay,
right.
Wow. And apparently this was like in the course of being already reviewed by the administration for behavioral problems.
Right. So that's a person that needs to go. Just very clear. Not go in the same sense they would say, but just like does not belong on campus. What they are trying to organize is not peaceful in intent. However, there's a photo of the same protest, I believe, where there's this white dude, long hair, in front of a Hezbollah flag holding an acoustic guitar. He is there to pick up chicks. Excuse the expression, but that is exactly what's happening there. I bet if you talk to that guy, he has no idea any of the details of what is happening between Israel and Gaza right now. He is there because it is just the place. So you can't just judge, even in a very clear-cut incident of protests, you have to say, okay, are people getting violent? Is the rhetoric getting, you know, calling for violence, that sort of thing? Yes, then absolutely you should shut it down, no matter who they are, no matter what cause they're supporting. But if they're just sitting on the lawn, holding, you know, strumming an acoustic guitar, hopefully you can get the tear gas to land in front of someone else.
I think the answer to this question is markedly different between private and public universities. Some of the largest demonstrations like this are happening at private universities, elite private universities.
Like Columbia, yes.
And there you have to have a very hard conversation about what is the school for? Is it for the reception of knowledge? Is it for teaching? Is it for research? I think those are all very legitimate things. I don't think a university should be a debating society or a public forum or a platform on which whoever has whatever convictions they would like are able to seize and appropriate for those reasons. At public universities, this is harder because we have a First Amendment in this country and these are public institutions. Ben Sasse, I think, has done a nice job outlining what a response at a public university should be. But where these protests are most egregious in their excesses are in institutions that precisely have more flexibility than public universities. And they need to seriously take a look at, I think there was a New York Times story, I'll find the story if it wasn't the Times, but somebody was talking about they were experiencing disciplinary action for activity and protests. And they said, you know, I was literally accepted to this university on a merit scholarship based on my activism in high school. They were a student, I believe, in Florida that highlighted in their application essay that they protested certain elements of Florida law. And they thought that this is what they were here for, that this is literally what the university was writing the checks for them to come and do. I don't think that's disingenuous. I think that this person, social movements have been valorized in this country for so long that there are people that think that this is what should happen, that this is what these institutions exist for. They exist to be a platform for this sort of activism. And America's elite private universities need to decide whether or not that's what they want to do going forward. And this is a moment that I hope they'll take to consider that.
There was this comes up every once in a while, that there was some student who was admitted to Stanford. And then it was revealed that the personal statement that they wrote in order to get accepted to Stanford was just hashtag Black Lives Matter 100 times. And that got them accepted to one of the elite universities in this country. Dan, I think, highlights one of the big problems here, which is the identity crisis that a lot of these elite institutions, particularly universities, are having over why are we here and what are we here for? you have this problem compounded by the fact that a lot of people in administration and faculty are the actual people who were protesting things like the Vietnam War in the 1970s and have this idea of protest being this important part of the DNA of a university because it was so important to them. And you get these incredible statements like one that I saw that, you know, it's like history always venerates the protesters. I'm like, man, you don't even have to go back that long in history for me to get you to admit that you don't actually believe that. I was at a lot of Tea Party protests. Do you believe that history has inevitably vindicated the Tea Party protesters? I'm pretty sure you're not going to agree with me on that front. But no, this is a very real crisis in the question of what are these universities for? And, you know, what form should activism of any type play on a campus like this? Dylan, you're absolutely correct. Like you can find these videos of people being asked, like, what are we out here protesting? And a lot of these people have no idea what they're out there protesting. It is that kind of thing that there is anonymity in a mob and you want to be a part of something that is interesting and seems fun and seems cool. So it draws more people into it because it anonymizes the behavior that you commit while you are involved in such a thing. There is a legitimate tension between you know, how you are going to deal with these kinds of things. We have seen the police be brought in to break up some of them like we saw at the University of Texas. I think the far more powerful thing would be if, you know, and you don't have to do everybody, but certainly the leaders would be a good place to start. Find the people who are leading these encampments and expel them. Expel them from these universities because what are they hoping to get from these universities? It is this important credentialization. It is the access to an elite strata of society that you get because you went to Columbia, because you went to Harvard, because you went to Yale, the things that you get as a result of all of that. Expel these people. Make them face real consequences in a way that arresting them almost burgeons their credentials. Expelling them seems to be the only thing to me that will really have a meaningful impact on how these people will view or at least other people will look at these kinds of activities and think this is really not what college is for. Anything that can be done to get people back to the purpose of, I agree, what I think the university is for, education, is a good move. But you just see it's so obvious how hamstrung a lot of these people are who run these universities. They don't know how to deal with this. They're sympathetic, if not on the arguments of a lot of the protesters in these encampments, certainly to the idea that what they're doing is important and they got to enforce that. I don't think that's actually true. And I think that we are going to see some major soul searching. If we don't, it's going to be a disappointment. But we need to see some major soul searching from the people who lead these institutions about the question of what they exist for and what they exist to do.
Yeah, I would just help them out. As you mentioned, you need not be confused what a university is for. It is for education. It is to prepare students for the real world. It is not supposed to be an escape from the real world.
What did Milton Friedman say?
Fill them with delusion.
A pleasant interlude between high school and real life.
Hey, it's fine if it's on the path towards real life. I get that. It is a break. It's not real life. All right, just to be clear, I know there's a lot of confused people out there. College campuses, university campuses are not real life. That's true right and left. I hear people complaining all the time about the way they think it is. And I find out, oh, this person teaches at a university. They don't understand real life. It's like living inside of Twitter. All right. It's insane and it's not real. But there is a very clear purpose and there's a very real crisis in higher education right now that can be traced to this confusion over no one knowing why they exist. If you are a college or university president or administrator and you are confused as to whether you should spend your time and resources on educating students to learn how to think better and be better prepared for real life or giving them a space to virtue signal whatever the trendiest new thing is, just quit your job because you're terrible at it. And you're going to run that place into the ground. And it will be tragic for anyone who spent thousands of dollars to go there with the hope of getting an education. So do your jobs.
Let's call it a wrap there. Thank you for listening to Act and Unwind. If you're listening to this podcast on our website, please look in the show notes for a link where you can subscribe directly to Act and Unwind. Or just search Act and Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Also, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. 5-star reviews only, so that more people can find this show. I want to again encourage you to subscribe to our magazine, Religion and Liberty, where you can read not only Karen's great essay that we discussed today, but other great pieces by Mike Cosper, Anthony Bradley, Jean Edward Veith, Dan Huger, and many more. Only $29.99 will get you 4 issues of our beautiful magazine in your mailbox 4 times a year. Look in the show notes for this episode for a link where you can subscribe. Thanks to Dylan, thanks to Dan, and a big thanks to Karen Swallow Pryor. For the Acton Institute, I'm Eric Cohn. We'll see you next week.